Now at McDonald's, a McDouble is only $2.50. So you can get your gym gains on or just get lunch for only $2.50. Get more value on the under $3 menu.
Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The Murdaugh case didn't start at the kennels. It started in patterns. Patterns of control, patterns of manipulation, and staging that Alec had been perfecting for years. The Family Man by James Lasden traces those patterns through original reporting and interviews that go deeper than anything that came out at his trial. What emerges isn't a portrait of a man who snapped in the moment. It's a portrait of a man who'd been rehearsing, or really had been doing himself, being Alec, all this time. It just seems that the perspective of adding a little murder to the mix made people look a little bit differently at it. James, thank you so much for joining us. Very much looking forward to having this conversation about this this book, The Family Man. I want to ask you, before we kind of get into the meat of the book, what is your relationship to the story? Meaning, like, when did you hear about it? What drew you in? And what made you say, I think there's more to tell here than just what we've been hearing thus far?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to come and talk to you about it. I think I first came across the story in the same way as most people, certainly most people out who weren't very close to the sort of news in South mm-hmm. Carolina, which was the news of the murders, that Maggie and Paul had been found shot dead at the kennels at Moselle. And, you know, I mean, at that point, it seemed brutal. You know, there was talk of a vendetta against the family, but it didn't seem, you know, it didn't have all the sort of weirdness that it later revealed. And, mm-hmm. So I noted it, but I wasn't, you know, it didn't make me feel, oh, I've got to write about this. And then 3 months later, in September of 2021, you have this strange incident on the side of a road in Buckingham, Moselle, where the bereaved Alec claims to have been shot while changing a tire. I mean, he said he had pulled over to the side of the road to change a tire, and somebody drove past him and took a shot at him. So it really did look like there was a vendetta against the family. Mm-hmm. But that story fell apart very quickly. And the next thing we heard a day or two after was that Alec had been confronted by colleagues at his law office and accused of stealing, and had admitted that he had stolen millions over the years from his law partners and from his clients. And he claimed at that point that he had hired his cousin, Eddie, to shoot him dead so that his surviving son, Buster, could claim the life insurance. And this was the story that people went with at that point. In time, that story sort of started falling apart as well. Uh-huh. The main problem with it, or one of many problems, being that, yeah, if Eddie had taken a shot at him, why wasn't he dead? I mean, he did have, it was very mysterious, because he did have entrance and exit wounds at the back of his head on a very sort of light injury. Uh-huh. So bullet does seem to have hit him. Who fired it? Why? It was a mystery. But yeah, at that point, I started getting interested because, I write novels mostly, and I'd once written a novel with a twist where a guy hires someone or asks someone to kill him so that someone he loves can claim the life insurance. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I'd always felt that this was a bit of a stretch. But here, it seemed like life was bearing me out.
Yeah.
So I got interested.
I mean, I was just going to say that. I mean, this is one of those cases where if you were to script it out, nobody would be like, oh, yeah, let's run with that. I think it would be like, we got to pull this back a little bit. Like, you're going a bit too far. This is too not realistic. But no, in this case, it seems reality is stranger than fiction. One of the key elements to this story that eventually seemingly led, if we're understanding the story correctly, of Alec Murdaugh to his demise began with a boat crash, the Mallory Beach boat crash. And I want to talk about that because you bring up some interesting points in this book. Most people believe Paul was driving the boat when it crashed and killed Mallory Beach. But the book reveals that Morgan Dowtry, Paul's girlfriend, wrote in her first statement that night that Connor Cook took over driving before the crash. And I'm not here to cast disparagements on anybody. I'm just going off of what the information is that exists out there, because it's all part of this story. Her exact words were, we putted around until Connor took over. We slammed into the bridge. Then a nurse saw Miley Altman whispering something in Morgan's ear the next day. Morgan got upset and asked to rewrite her statement. That's what in the book. The book argues the accepted version of who was driving was essentially constructed after the fact. And this has been something that's been in all of the docs, all of the dramatizations of this. Who was driving the boat? Tell me about this factoid that you have uncovered and you're talking about in the book, and why does it matter to the murder case? What conclusion have you come to in this?
Well, first of all, I think Paul almost certainly was driving the boat. Mm-hmm. And that anyway, he was sort of morally responsible for what happened. So I'm mm-hmm. not trying to in any way argue that he wasn't responsible, but there was a lot more uncertainty than people seem to have come to believe. And, Morgan changed her story diametrically from mm-hmm. Connor to Paul. But the other three, in their various ways, were all expressed a degree of uncertainty on the night before they kind of consolidated their testimony. And all of this uncertainty is in the documentation. It's in the initial police reports. Mm-hmm. And, there's been an argument that the police were in some way suborned by the Murdaugh family. But, there may have been a degree of that. I suspect there probably was. But even without that, there is this uncertainty. And Morgan's reversal of her written testimony is the most kind of glaring. What's important about it is that in the aftermath of the murder, there was reason to believe that Paul would not necessarily, even though he was criminally indicted for the killing of Mallory Beach, not the murder, the accidental death, mm-hmm. the vehicular homicide of Mallory Beach, there was a general perception that he might get off, that he might, the Murdaughs were very powerful. They had a lot of sway over local juries, and they were a very powerful family. They had hired the top lawyer in the state, the most powerful lawyer in the state, Dick Harpootlian, to defend Paul. And in order for Alec's scenario with the murders, that the murders were a vendetta killing against Paul, by vigilantes, in order for that to have any kind of plausibility, there you have to accept that there was a perception that Paul might not have paid the price in a court mm-hmm. of law, and that therefore it was plausible that some vigilantes were either going to sort of, execute justice on him or at least preempt a failure of injustice. So. Mm-hmm. So it's like I call it the gearing mechanism that connects the boat accident to the murders. And I think that that gearing mechanism doesn't really work if you accept that everybody believed and that Paul was going to be found guilty for the killing of Mallory Beach. I think you have to understand that there was a question in the air whether he really would be found guilty. And that's because there was uncertainty around the testimony. And I think there is a degree of uncertainty about who was driving. I mean, they were switching back and forth constantly. Mm-hmm. They were both pretty drunk. They both were, Anthony Cook, you don't often see this quotation, but it's in his deposition, was extremely angry with his cousin Connor, as well as with Paul, for their kind of horseplay on the boat before the crash. So that story got streamlined, and it does a disservice to one's understanding of how Alec could have ever imagined people would believe that the killing of Maggie and Paul was a vigilante act.
That's interesting.
I hope that makes sense. Yeah. It's complicated.
No, it's a long distance connecting of the dots, but I get it. And I think anybody who's followed the story long enough gets it too. The question would be then, because Alec, obviously, the accusation has been that he went in there, him and his father went in there, and they were flashing their badges around, and they were trying to convince other people to say that, no, it was not Paul that was driving the boat. It was Connor over here that was driving the boat.
Definitely. Well, initially they seem to have been trying to create a scenario.
Yeah.
Nobody knows who was driving the boat.
Yeah, and so they're trying to create that scenario, but was that, I guess, from your findings, how accurate was that, maybe, that people were genuinely confused of who was driving the boat, and Alec and his father saw that as an opportunity to sow further confusion to construct their own narrative?
I think that was the case. There was confusion. There was uncertainty. Mm-hmm. There was actually, the only kind of absolutely certain written statement right at the get-go was Morgan saying that it was Connor. So, but you had spoken statements that just were expressing uncertainty on the first night. Even
sure.
Cook said, you know, if it was Connor, it happened after I fell back into the boat, because he fell back after the boat sped up. He fell back and he sort of passed out for a bit. He went to sleep, he said. So even in his testimony, you can see how Alec and Randolph, you know, his Alec's father, these seasoned lawyers, could see, okay, there's confusion here. We can make this work so that kind of at least our son doesn't get the blame for this, and maybe nobody will get the blame.
Yeah, if you can cause enough confusion about all of it, then how do you go after anybody specifically?
Exactly.
Yeah. But that might have been
lost very long.
Yeah.
They then did clearly start trying to pin it on Connor. Mm-hmm. They were trying to do that. There's no question.
Without a doubt.
That doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't Connor. Sure. But it became expedient for them to do it. They were very powerful. They tried to set up Connor's family with Corey Fleming as a lawyer, and Corey Fleming, who later turns out to be his main conspirator in the embezzlements, one of the two main conspirators. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely evidence for that. Meanwhile, I think the other people on the boat, Miley and Morgan and Connor and Anthony, were in a way consolidating their story to implicate and incriminate Paul. Mm-hmm. And there's elements of that don't sit well with me either. I mean, I understand why they would do it, but you get, you know, Anthony saying that he didn't have conversations with Paul between the boat crash and the time he gave his deposition, but it turns out Connor and he did talk, and they seem to have agreed on a story. Again, I'm not trying to in any way shift the blame for this onto Connor.
Sure.
I'm just saying not only are there grounds for uncertainty, but those grounds for uncertainty are what make it a powerful instrument when it comes to this vigilante scenario that Alec came up with
Yeah, it actually lends some more credence to it. That does make sense when it's contextualized that way. I want to talk about some other aspects here about just kind of setting the story of Alec Murdaugh and who he was behind the scenes before the murders took place, the relationships, the connections that he had. This one does take us right up to the actual murders itself. It involves the former police or police chief, the Yosemite police chief named Greg Alexander. He was at Moselle at the crime scene the night of the murders. 1 month later, Alec wrote him a personal check for $5,000 and backdated it to March. This is another interesting thought part in the book. The chief said it was a loan for his parents. Alec just writing a $5,000 loan to his police chief friend who happened to be there the night of the murders. Never explained the backdating part. Nobody's really accounted for what that payment actually was. What's your thoughts there? I mean, it's a little weird. It feels like in any other case, it'd be kind of a big deal that would get brought up at trial in some way, shape, or form. But this was obviously never brought up. Maybe it is as innocent as it is. It's a smaller community out there in the back country, in the low country, but still, I mean, you just had the murder take place not that long ago, and you're writing a check to somebody who was on the team of investigating it. It kind of lands with a bit of head scratching. What's your thoughts?
Very much so. I mean, some of it did come up at the trial. Greg Alexander, who's the chief of police in Yemisi, was an old sort of, it was part of the sort of Murdaugh family. I mean, it was described to me by Will Folks at the at Fitz News, who covered and broke a lot of the story, as a fixer for the family. And at the trial, it was brought up for rather mysterious reasons that he used to come to the office, to Alec Murdaugh's office, and get kind of cash loans from him. And they also brought up he had been accused, indicted for stealing $10,000 in sort of like the petty cash from traffic fines. Mm-hmm. And he was put on trial. This came up at the murder trial. He was put on trial in one of the courthouses that the Murdaugh family sort of control. And Alec and his father attended the trial. They sat in the front and made their presence very known. And the police chief was acquitted. They didn't say at the murder trial, they didn't say really why they were bringing this up, but it was clearly to cast some sort of aspersions on Greg Alexander, but they didn't say why. And they didn't let it be known, you know, what they were driving at with this rather emphatic connecting of Alec to a police chief who'd had some trouble. Mm-hmm. However, various things have sort of come out since, you know, there's this check. I don't believe the check was mentioned during the trial, but it was known about by the time of the trial. I could be wrong about that. It might have come up, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
He definitely he wrote a check to him a few days after the murder. Alec wrote a check to Chief Alexander for $5,000, as you said, and backdated it to March for some reason. Chief Alexander says it was a loan for his parents. Well, it does make you scratch your head. And there's a lot of murk around this case. Yeah. And one of the areas of murk is, well, there are two things where the name of Chief Alexander gets sort of muttered. And I don't want to sort of say anything incriminating or libelous about him, but these
No.
are the areas where the questions arise. Somebody or the weapons were never recovered.
Mm-hmm.
So there's surmise that somebody was involved in hiding the weapons. I highly doubt that it was a police chief.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably was Alec himself. But you know that question arose because the investigators of the crime didn't search the Almeida property where Alec had driven that night. For 3 months after the murder. So, which was an unthinkable omission, I think. So there's that murky part about what happened to the weapons, which have never been found. The other piece of murky, very murky stuff is Maggie's car, her Mercedes, was found at the house, which is a quarter mile away from the kennels. However, there seems to have been a belief, that the car had been by the kennels and had been moved back up to the house after the murders. Mm-hmm. I was told this by Mark Tinsley, who was very close to the prosecution. He was one of the lawyers who was driving this case, one of the civil litigators.
Yep.
And I said, well, you know, I had been confused because one of the prosecutors had surmised that Maggie got killed because she had gone back to her car. She was at the kennels. She had gone back to her car, heard a shot, and run back to the kennels. Now, she could only have done that if her car was already quite close to the kennels, not a quarter mile away. She wouldn't mm-hmm. have run that quarter of a mile. She would have driven it. Also, the seat of the car was all the way back as if somebody much larger than Maggie had been driving it. And what Mark Tinsley told me was that there's some thought that somebody at the crime scene moved the car, which would be a pretty stupid thing for any of the cops to. I mean, you don't do that. Mm-hmm. So you start thinking, well, who was at the crime scene who might have been able to do that? And again, Chief Alexander was at the crime scene. It's not part of his jurisdiction. He was there. The explanation for why he was there was it had to do with this very complicated set of sort of road mishaps, car mishaps that afflicted Alex's brother, John Marvin, who was rushing to the scene, was afraid that the truck he was driving, which belonged to Paul, was going to break down. So he called Chief Alexander and said, will you escort me to Moselle, which Chief Alexander did. The truck did in fact break down. John Marvin gets into the chief's car. They go to the scene and they become part of this melee at Moselle, which was another problem. You know, you had so many people descending on the estate.
Yeah.
And it wasn't properly secured. And yeah, so
and there's a lot of things with law enforcement in this case that when you look at other cases that would have had more experienced investigators on, you look at this and go, oh my God, what were they doing? But I think a lot of times the answer in this case, at least the conclusion I've come to, is the fact that this is a team that really isn't that experienced in homicides or this sort of crime. And so it makes you go, oh, well, a lot of these kind of rookie mistakes that one may look at and go, is this a cover-up of some sort? It's like, yeah, or inexperience. The two can look very similar. But you're right. There are these elements that just don't make a lot of sense. And I'm not casting disparagements on the chief or anybody saying that they were involved in a cover-up. But there's just enough where this case makes you scratch your head and you look a little bit closer. And then as you look closer, you just realize there's more gray area. There's so much here with so few absolutes that just lead to so many more questions. But it seems to really be the way that Alec Murdaugh and the Murdaughs in general, going back saying, speaking of his father and whatnot, they've always kind of operated in a little bit off the radar, off the rails way, where the rules don't quite apply to us. You in the book trace back to a connection to Alec Murdaugh's connection to a jellyfish processing business. I don't even know that was a business, just miles from Moselle, that involved co-owned properties with a family tied to drug smuggling. The lawyer for that operation was convicted in the 1980s during something called Operation Jackpot for laundering money, drug money, through offshore accounts and reinvesting in South Carolina real estate. 30 years later, he's working with Alec's associates, allegedly. So Alec, I mean, he's got some ties here to some questionable folks or people who've had some questionable past. It's not Alec is just, he's the attorney at this up and up law firm and everything is all, you know, kosher. There's a lot of folks that he has surrounded himself with that are questionable at best. And I think that that leads to even more questions about could anybody have some reason to be angry at Alec. Obviously, financially, it turns out, yes. But it makes you wonder, was there other things involved? Is there another piece to this story that we are just not seeing or fully understanding or fully grasp? of why someone would want Maggie and Paul gone, either or Alec as well. What's your take here before we get deeper into that on that connection there to the jellyfish farming?
It was very strange that he had been buying up pieces of land, some with colleagues at PMPED, the law firm, but also quite a few of them with this man, Bowler. It's spelled Boulware, but it's pronounced Bowler, apparently, who had been a drug smuggler. He was one of the so-called gentleman smugglers who mostly pot into South Carolina. And there's a very good book about them called Jackpot by Mike's gone blank, but it's a good book. You know, they live a very glamour life, and it was fairly known in the Low Country who were and what they were doing. And they, you know, they were, because they were only smuggling pot, and they didn't use weapons and things. They didn't have guns. They were sort of able to project a certain kind of glamour. And I think that Alec Murdoch was very sort of taken with that. He was younger than Bowler and probably first sort of encountered the stories of the gentleman smugglers when he was a teenager. And I imagine that he was quite glamorized by the sort of stories of them flying their girlfriends to Paris on the Concorde and having, you know, sex parties on their boats and all the rest of it. And so he then goes into business with Bowler and they buy land together. And I talked at length with Will Folks, the editor of Fitz News, who I mentioned before, and he had been looking into all this. He felt that these properties, there was always a question, well, what were these properties for? They never actually developed them. They didn't sell them when the market went up. And they were part of the reason that Alex got in trouble when the market went down, because his partners could no longer help pay the kind of costs, the taxes and the loans and all the rest of it. And Bowler couldn't pay that. But Will Folks's conjecture was that these places would have made very good offloading sites for drug smuggling. They were very well hidden. Some of them you could only get to when the tide was right. And he felt that the jellyfish business, which Alec went into, not with Bowler, in fact, that was, I believe, with some of his colleagues from PMPED, was likely a kind of cover or something. The short answer is we really don't know. I mean, there are some sketchy characters who sort of form a part of the jellyfish business. It was very short-lived. The local people, it's a really filthy industry. It involves a lot of kind of very unpleasant waste and bad smells kind of drifting because over to islands where, you know, there are golf clubs and sort of genteel people do not want rotting jellyfish. And they actually got it closed. Well, there was a legal battle, and this man who'd been a lawyer back in the day and been arrested, the man you spoke about, 30 years later, he's representing Alec and his colleagues in this fight to close down the jellyfish plant, which they lost. It was closed down. Mm-hmm. It was only operating for a fairly short time, I think under a year. That's one of the unanswered questions.
Why do you think there are so many unanswered questions in this case? I mean, do you, it makes you wonder, it makes me wonder, obviously, you know, Alec is away. I don't think it's necessarily to protect Alec anymore. Alec is down for the count. But an operation like that, other things that Alec was into, it required more than Alec to be involved in it. And then you have some shady characters that have been involved in some of these things. It makes me start to wonder if there are other operations that exist, and I don't know what they are, and I don't know who's involved in them, but it makes me wonder, and I think it kind of goes back to the question of, you know, if Alec did this, did he do it himself, meaning the murder? Or were there other people involved? Or was this some sort of a revenge hit of some sort? And maybe Alec didn't do it at all. But are there other people? Is there something else going on here? Because there clearly seems to be other areas of this case that I would think would have been investigated further, should have been investigated further, of the possibility of other people being involved in this that just simply were not explored, period. And that's what makes me, and the question is, why? Why weren't they explored further? And then you look at who's investigating it, and you look at the higher ups around those folks in the community that can control things of who gets investigated, gets investigated, and what doesn't. It makes me wonder, again, I'm not trying to be conspiracy theorist here, but I'm just trying to connect the dots going, why wasn't there a closer look at some of these areas? Because it sure looks like there's some smoke in some places.
I mean, I agree, but I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all. And I tend to think that these things happen for kind of more mundane reasons. I mean, I think you've got they don't have limitless resources, the investigators.
Sure.
I think their focus rightly was on solving the murder. In the course of doing that, they dig up sort of connections to the Cowboys gang in Walterboro. You've got, drugs there. Obviously, all the embezzlements came mm-hmm. to light. You've got his connections to shady people who he was calling on the day itself. That, to me, is one of the oddest unanswered questions. Part of the problem is that they don't tell you. I mean, SLED, I tried to talk to them. I tried to ask them all these questions. Why didn't, why do we not know really about what the drugs, the opioid, the whole question of what, did he really consume that many opioids himself? Mm-hmm. Was he just a consumer of them, or was he dealing them? That there are allegations that he was part of a sort of, that he was actually selling them as well as part
yeah.
of them. They never got to the bottom of that. And I don't know if they intend to, or if they've basically done what they felt they needed to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, well, once you got there, your ace in the hole and he's behind bars, why keep looking deeper, I guess. But but with this possibly being relitigated, depending on what the Supreme Court of South Carolina says, who knows? I mean, nothing would surprise me in this case at this point. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue our conversation here with James Lasden, author of The Family Man, this new book on the Alec Murdaugh saga, Blood and Betrayal in the House of Murdaugh. The prosecution told a clean story at trial. Alec killed them, cleaned up, drove to his mother's, came back, called 911. The jury believed it, but the family man surfaces details that were never presented to that jury. Deleted phone logs, unexplained contacts, unidentified tire tracks, a car seat that doesn't make sense. None of it proves Alec didn't do it, but the book makes a case that whatever happened in those 13 minutes of silence at Mosaic may have been more complicated than either side told the actual jury. James, I want to get into some of those phone calls that happened in the timeline here, June 7th. Alec made that day with two men with criminal records, Kenneth Singleton and Dimitric Mangio. Mangio, yeah. Singleton texted Alec asking him to call, and Alec replied telling him to come to his office for a loan. Alec deleted his entire call log then from June 4th through the 911 call. Cousin Eddie texted him the next morning with three words, at fishing hole. Prosecutors left most of this out of the timeline when they showed the jury. I guess, the question is why. Maybe they didn't need those blocks to build the story on Alec, but it still certainly leaves the question, why? Why was he communicating with these people? What was going on? You had just mentioned that in our last segment of these bizarre phone calls with these two, people who have some history to them. What'd you come to as a conclusion while doing your research for the book?
I mean, it's very mysterious, and I mean, there are two mysteries. One, what was he talking to them about? And why did SLED not present this to the jury? It was on the expanded timeline, but it was not on the compressed timeline that was given to the jury. And I think clearly they didn't want them to be distracted. And I think the defense probably didn't want to bring them up either, because, you know, they were going for an absolute, Alec had nothing to do with this defense. So it was in, probably both sides thought it was in their interest not to dig into this. But, you know, it certainly interested me. I tried to get hold of both of those people. I couldn't. I assume that SLED looked into that. I mean, they must have. I couldn't get an answer out of them about whether they had it. I'm very reluctant to accuse them of sort of sweeping inconvenient things out of the way. But I certainly would like to know the answer to that. Were they just somehow his drug suppliers? But that doesn't seem to be that. He seems to have got his drugs through the intermediary of his cousin Eddie. There are other people with gang connections who got swept up in the investigation. Spencer and a guy called Spencer and a guy called Roberts. I forget their names anyway. Who had got rid of a phone that the police were looking for in connection with the Murdoch killings. And these were kind of people with criminal records, and they were described by Creighton Waters, the prosecutor, as downstream beneficiaries of Alec's crimes. We never really found out that whole sort of murky or sort of surround of these people. We never found out really what they were doing in his life. And of course, when you have that kind of uncertainty, you question, well, is something not really being looked at very closely? Why ask any of these questions in the first place? You're dealing with a guy who's self-evidently a terrible guy. He'd stolen from people who trusted him, very vulnerable people. He stole millions from them. He's done terrible things. For me, the question was, okay, he's a terrible guy, he's done all these things, but that's a different order of crime from murdering your own son, particularly. And I found myself very reluctant to accept this official explanation that, well, he got himself into all kinds of terrible trouble, the shit was about to hit the fan, so he killed his son as a distraction. Turn himself into a victim so that the civil suit would go away, so that his law firm would stop looking at these possible... I mean, they hadn't actually accused him of theft at that point, but they were...
Yeah.
And so, kill your son. I mean, I couldn't quite go there. There was a kind of gap in the logic. And I'm used to writing fiction. And in fiction... Yeah. You have to understand your characters. You have to be able to follow them through the sequence of their actions. And part of the reason I wrote the book, and part of what the book is for me, is getting over that kind of gap in the story.
Mm-hmm. Getting to Family Annihilator is not an easy step. In any case, really, but. Even more in this one, because this is not a man who was estranged from his family or was looked down on by his family or really anybody for the most part. Alec was the jovial kind of folksy guy that everybody pretty much got along with. Obviously, behind the scenes, he was doing some pretty nasty shit. But that was financial. It seems the relationships he had with people were authentic. At least the people that were around him believed they were, and he was pretty damn good at convincing him of that. It really doesn't track. That's the problem with the whole damn story, is it just doesn't track. But when we learn about other family annihilators and such, sometimes it does track this way, where it is something so dramatically different than on the surface with what they are capable of doing. But it is a very hard thing to wrap your mind around, just trying to get there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you do when you're trying to understand something as sort of extreme as this is you look for precedents.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what took me to the literature of sort of criminology and, you know, the studies of other families. It's pretty rare family annihilating, but it happens. And there mm-hmm. are studies and they make interesting reading. And among them, you know, they all had something in common with Alec. Obviously, they killed their families or members of their family. Mm-hmm. And they mostly have quite a few things in common. A lot of them are men who have lived a little bit of a double life, outwardly very successful, very functional. Behind it is this sort of secret life of embezzlement or whatever in many cases. And things start to go wrong and they're confronted with downfall, with ruin, with shame. And they kill their families. And in most cases, in 90% of the cases, they kill themselves too.
Yeah.
Because shame is what's driving them, partly what's driving them. And he didn't do that. I mean, maybe 3 months later, maybe that's what was going on. I don't think that's what was going on the old Salkahatchee Road, but he certainly claimed that that was what was going on. But it wasn't, that was 3 months later. It wasn't part of the attack on his family. In all these other, almost all these other cases, it's in the same kind of gesture, the same event. They turn their guns on themselves mm-hmm. most of the time. So that was a difference. Another difference was in most of the cases, the children are young, or if mm-hmm. they're not very young, they're very defenseless. I couldn't find a single case where a father in this situation, who's facing shame, facing ruin, kills a grown-up, autonomous, very capable 22-year-old who's seldom out of reach of a loaded gun, which was the case with Paul. Mm-hmm. Hell of a risk to try to kill that person and then know that you've got to then kill his fairly formidable mother afterwards. Mm-hmm. This was pretty unique, if that was what happened. It was almost unique. There are many things that he had in common, but there are some things that seemed so singular.
Yeah. I want to talk about Cousin Eddie. He's described what happened at Moselle as things just got really effed up. Alec, in the book, I'm trying to make sure I'm going to state this correctly, kind of in the book, you kind of take the stance that maybe Alec staged this as a fake attack on his family that was supposed to fail, a near miss to generate sympathy and distract from the financial investigation. And it would make some sense using the real threats against Paul as cover. And then the same play running, you know, 3 months later on the roadside with Eddie, where Alec is injured. Explain that a little bit more. Was this something, in your opinion, in your thought process, that went horribly awry? Was this supposed to not be a murder? Did something go horribly wrong and two people ended up dead? And you know, Alec, in a way, actually was telling the truth on the stand that he never did intend to kill his wife and his son.
I mean, I spent a lot of time, because I had such resistance to the thought that he could have done this.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time trying to think, well, what could have happened? And yeah. trying to come up with an alternate theory. And any theory would have to be consistent with all the facts that we know. They'd have to be consistent with the sort of personality, such as we know it, of Alec. They'd have to be consistent with why he lied about going to the kennel and why he lied about his lie. In other words, when he took the stand allegedly to explain the lie, why he then lied again. And I really had given up. Mm-hmm. You know, there really didn't seem to be anything that would be consistent with those things. And then there was this phrase that Cousin Eddie used on his Netflix interview, and he used it again when I went to talk to him a second time, which was that he had, it was actually on the day of the roadside shooting, he had met Alex, and he claimed that one of the things Alex said to him was, it all got fucked up. Eddie had asked him about what happened at Moselle, and Alex said, it all got fucked up. And I didn't think very much of it at the time, but afterwards I thought, after a while I started thinking, well, wait a minute, What got fucked up?
It's a weird way to describe the death of your family.
Yeah. What yeah. got fucked up? And what would it have been if it had not been fucked up? And then I thought, well, you know, what do we know about what is one of the kind of really fundamental things that Alec does? He stages elaborate scenarios. He tried to make the murders look like it was the work of two people. On the old Salkehatchee Road, he tries to make it look as if somebody took a shot at him. Some vigilante stranger took a shot at him. This is what he does. This is where his mind goes when he's sort of under pressure. And we know that he was in touch with a lot of sketchy people. Maybe some of them would have been willing if he offered them money or if he had mm-hmm. some other kind of hold over them, because he often used compromised people who he did have some kind of hold over. Would there have been some people who might have been willing to take part in a scenario that involved what would have appeared to be an attempted shooting of Paul and Maggie that was not supposed to kill them?
Yeah. It's like,
I wondered.
Yeah. I mean, I get the theory. I mean, I still wonder to this day if there's something else awry here. Not that Alec has nothing to do with it, but something of this nature has taken place. It makes me, what I guess, play that scenario out. I mean, how do you attempt to murder them? I mean, or is this like just some sort of drug-fueled idea that was in Alec's mind with other drug-fueled idiots? And, oh, yeah, this will be great in their conversation. And then it gets executed and, whoops, he accidentally blew his head off.
Well, I think if that was, you know, how it began, that this was a scenario that he wanted to make happen.
Yeah,
clearly it went wrong. How it was supposed to happen and how it went wrong, I don't. You know, it's hard. There's so many variables, but you do have Paul, who's a very kind of volatile guy. He's been threatened. He's pretty much always got a loaded gun near him. It's not hard to see how he might have not reacted the way he was supposed to react if he thought someone was creeping through the dark woods towards him with a gun, or if he got into a confrontation or whatever. Maybe Maggie was a collateral victim under that scenario. I don't know. Yeah. But I don't think it's inconceivable that some kind of scenario could have happened like that and gone wrong. And, you know, you might have had people who didn't want to leave anyone alive after they'd been discovered. It's perhaps a little bit far-fetched, but I don't see anything about it that's absolutely inconsistent with what we do know. Mm-hmm. And I just certainly don't think it's any more far-fetched than the official explanation of things. Do I think it's what happened? Almost certainly not. No, I think almost certainly it is the way the prosecutors described it. I mean, unbelievable as it is, I think probably Alec was alone. He probably did do it. I think some of the internal mental processes, thought processes, were not quite the way that the prosecution described them, and they didn't do much of that anyway. They didn't get into that, understandably. I was interested in getting into that, and I wanted to figure that out, and I feel that I did figure it out to some extent. But a lot of the people I spoke to after the trial, when I asked them, well, do you think that was the right verdict? Do you think that's what happened? They would say, yeah. And then they would say, well, yeah, like 95%.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your feedback on where we're at here. The trial answered the legal question, guilty, but it never touched the psychological one. How does a man cross that line? The Family Man goes further than any previous work on this case into the research on family annihilators, draw specific parallels to documented cases that mirrors Alec's almost, there's some differences, and builds a framework for understanding the murders that go beyond he snapped or that He's a sociopath. James Lasden is with us. He is the author of The Family Man. James, the book draws a direct comparison between Alec Murdaugh and another case that we had talked about briefly, Jean-Claude Romand, a Frenchman who faked being a doctor at the World Health Organization for 18 years. Imagine doing that. I mean, nobody checking your resume for 18 years. He had a wife, two small kids, community respect, and none of it was real. When the lies unraveled, he killed his wife, both kids, his parents, and the dog. He'd been living inside a fabricated life for almost two decades, just like Alec lived inside a fabricated version of his financial success. I know you you bring up the parallels here in the book. What is it about that comparison that makes this case make more sense to you?
I mean, it's still deeply mysterious for anyone to behave like that. But what it offers is simply the fact that someone else did it. It's precedent. And he's not the only one. That there are these patterns that occur, and even if that doesn't explain or make you really understand, it makes it believable. It makes it plausible that, okay, this is within the bounds of human behavior. It is possible for humans to do these things, and under certain kind of recognizable situations, this is a possibility. This is a possible outcome. So it's not an ultimate solution to the mystery, but it's a partial one. And but again, even Jean-Claude Romand, who does have a lot in common with Alec. I mean, he tried to kill himself. His children were very small, but he had a lot in common with him. He was faking being a doctor and stealing a lot of money through that. I mean, he would get his relatives to invest with him because he was telling them that he could get guaranteed 18% return on investments through the WHO. And they gave him a lot of money, and that was crashing down. And that's what precipitated his killing of his family. So, yeah, I mean, it does seem to be a pattern of a certain kind of, usually a man under certain sorts of pressure, will do this.
And it makes you wonder, you know, is this something, you know, was this planned? Was this premeditated? If it was, for how long? Co-prosecutor John Maders went somewhere different from the state's official theory in his closing. He said maybe Alec just lost it. Maybe it wasn't calculated. The book sits with both possibilities and points out that the research on psychopathy lists cunning, manipulative, and impulsivity as traits basically of the same condition. A person can meticulously plan, and they can also explode. Alec seemed to be someone who did a little bit of both. I mean, the way that he planned, it seems, the manipulation of money and his financial crimes, that was a long game. That wasn't a quick, let me take some money from you and hope you don't notice. He knew you had to have this duck in place and that duck in place and this person over here and that person over there to make that work. The way that this all ended, I mean, it seems to be, let's throw the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks, because there really didn't seem to be a whole lot more planned other than suddenly they're dead. What's my story? He was changing that up until the literal last minute, going onto the stand and then telling a different story than he ever had before. Where do you land after doing all your research on this? Premeditated or more spontaneous in the mind of Alec Murdaugh for the murders of his family?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I think he was someone who was always, whenever he was confronted with any kind of question, he was always gaming out different possible strategies simultaneously. Like when he heard that Gloria Satterfield had fallen down the steps at Moselle, I think that he was gaming out, well, what happens if she's okay? What happens if she dies? Should I say the dogs were involved? Would it be better not to say the dogs were involved? I've got my insurance company, my insurance that everyone knows about, but I've also got my secret balloon insurance that pays out millions. Is there a way I can get that to yield its money to me? I think all these things were going, would have been going through his head as he drove back from his office to Moselle to give his first, you know, to see what was going on and give his first statement to the EMS and to, you know, the insurance agents and all the rest of it. And I think he had a way of sort of prepping the ground for different kinds of eventualities. And I think that the same thing possibly was going on with the murders, that at one point, at one part of his mind, yes, I think he probably did start thinking quite early on, what advantage to me might there be from my family being killed? And I think he laid in place the things that would be necessary in order for that to happen, like possibly putting the guns down at the kennels, possibly luring Maggie to Moselle.
Mm-hmm.
Does that necessarily mean that he had made up his mind to do it? I don't think so. I think you can have the laying in place, the forethought, and you can have this sort of state of unknowing about whether or not he's actually going to do it. And I based this, so I think he went to the kennels. I mean, he'd left his phone behind, so part of him was prepping for it. But I think he also possibly surprised himself. I think that there was an element of this kind of, fuck it, I'll do it, if I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, oh yeah. We're both can almost simultaneously exist. I mean, it's a hard one because, like, if you killed them, how are you grieving them? People can do
that. I know, but yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah. There's also, in the case we talked about, in the Roman case, he has been much more sort of forthcoming about what was going through his mind. And he actually admitted that that kind of double thinking was going on in his own mind before he killed his family. Yeah, he'd bought the weapons beforehand. He bought the silencers. He bought the stuff that he needed. But he says he was telling himself these were all for different things, even though clearly they were for the thing that he did. So it doesn't in any way exonerate Alec, but yeah. It just, you know, you begin to sort of understand the thought processes, the mental trajectory.
I mean, it's kind of the thinking of an addict, which Alec is an addict. We know that. I mean, but it is also, you know, when you're a narcissist, which Alec clearly is a narcissist, it's an addiction to image. It's an addiction to, I want people to think of me this way, and I will go to whatever means possible to maintain that image so other people perceive me in the way I want them to. Damn anybody who gets in my way, whether it's my son, whether it's my wife. And it makes me wonder if it's kind of an addiction way of thinking of, well, my son screwed up my life royally with this whole boat incident. He looks like a fool. He looks like an idiot. He's not really a great representation of me. My wife looks like she's about to leave me. That's not going to look good for me. I don't want to kill either of them. I love them both. I'd like it all to be here, but my image is going to be tarnished if both of these things come to light. The trial, she leaves me. So that urge in that moment to destroy that, because the addiction is so strong to that image through the narcissism, that's what drives them to do it. It's like an addict of any other sort. They know taking this hit of whatever it may be is not going to be good for you long term, even short term probably not, but they still do it despite knowing exactly what the repercussions could be, because in that moment, it's going to scratch that itch. It makes me wonder if this is, as complex as it is, also as simple as it could be to explain.
That might be totally, totally right. That might be the explanation. He doesn't have the, you know, there's not much evidence of the kind of grandiosity fantasies that you get with those kinds of narcissists. There's not that kind of behavior, that kind of attitude is very alienating.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the kind of attitude that makes the people who surround you feel really kind of deep kinship. Mm-hmm. And what we do know about Alec is that the people who surrounded him loved him and thought of him as a, you know, they all, an enormous number of them described him as like a brother.
Yeah.
And that he was incredibly affable. He wasn't one of these sort of bragging, grandiose types of narcissists.
No, he was covert. He was a covert narcissist at it.
If that's what he was. I think I agree, we're in very kind of conjectural territory here.
But yeah, oh, completely, yeah.
But I mean, we do know that he had a huge drug problem. I tend to think that he's more like a classic sociopath, that side of him, or psychopath. Mm-hmm. Those people, in the classic definitions, often have an alcohol or drug problem. They are weirdly drawn to the crimes of embezzlement and fraud and forgery, these very sort of close betrayals of other people. Because that's an area of life that is run partly on trust. Mm-hmm. And someone who has at a deep level no care at all about other people can get in those little structures, those kinds of relationship, and be very treacherous and get away with it because they run on trust. Mm-hmm. And so they tend to do a lot of that. They're very cunning. It tends for most of them to be short-term cunning. Mm-hmm. They get caught quite quickly. They're mostly petty crooks, psychopaths and sociopaths. They mostly don't commit acts of violence. They go on doing it till they're caught, and they usually get caught fairly quickly. The big exceptions, people like Ali, are people who have a lot of protection around them. Mm-hmm. From getting caught. They have a world of enablers around them. And they can do these things. They see that they get away with them. They do it slightly worse next time. They up and up and up. They escalate the scale of what they're doing, which is what we saw with Alec. And they escalate the recklessness with which they do it because they're constantly being effectively told by the world, you can do whatever you want. You can get away with it. Nobody's going to get you. He had active enablers. Obviously, he had his co-conspirators. But beyond that, he had a law firm who clearly were not paying attention to what he was doing there. I mean, they should have had him for embezzlement long before they did. They had this check that he had kind of taken that was supposed to go to his brother, that he had managed to steal the money twice over from the same check, none of which was supposed to be for him. And they swept it under the rug. They caught him. He came up with some ridiculous excuse, but they decided that they were going to buy it. They should not have done that. There was no real oversight there.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was the beneficiary of a whole culture, mm-hmm, in which there was no oversight of these powerful individuals. Russell Lafitte at the Palmetto Bank was a beneficiary there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they enabled each other to do this. So they were taking these. I think he's still like a kind of classic petty crook in his thinking. It was a short term. It was very reckless. There was some cunning in it, but it was kind of stupid cunning.
Yeah.
He should have been caught way early on. And he wasn't because he was protected. And so things got onto this very grandiose scale. What was it driven by? Was it just driven by a sense of he's got to be, look good under all conditions? Was it this grandiosity that you mentioned? Maybe. I think that there's another explanation, which may sound even more far-fetched, which is the one that the classic book on psychopathy, The Mask of Sanity, which kind of laid out the groundwork for the terms that are used with around that subject, by Michael Harvey Kleckley. And he surmised that really the underlying desire of these people is a craving for disaster. That's what they're looking for, that their actions are a kind of what he called a protracted suicide. They, unlike most classic family annihilators, don't usually kill themselves, but their whole life story is a kind of drawn out self-destruction. And I think you can sort of see that with Alec. There was a kind of, he was doing things that were just so increasingly risky and reckless that you wonder if at some sort of level this was all a kind of desire that he was in some way kind of luxuriating in his own destruction, because that was what was going on. And it's too bad that it had to involve the lives of other people.
Unfortunately, I think that exists in people, and I could see that in Alec Murdaugh. James Lasdin, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your book, The Family Man, available wherever you get books. Very fascinating, and a very fascinating look and your research into it. Top notch. Thank you again so much for coming on. We'll have the link in the description if you want to go check out the book for yourself. Your thoughts in the comment section as well. Substack, YouTube, drop them in there, and we'd love to read them. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.